are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 27th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, University of Richmond Professor of Law Ann Hodges on what will be the unintended consequences of the Wright's Supreme Court case to destroy public sector unions. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department North Korean point man, calls it quits. Good timing.
Got other things to do.
And the Georgia State Senate leader vows to attack Delta Airlines unless it continues to work with the NRA. Federal court, DACA work permits get more judicial protection. And anti-Semitic, what is this? Incidents soar to their highest level since 1979.
God exists.
Oregon passes net neutrality through its house. And a Republican conflict of interest saves a key Obama labor ruling. Meanwhile, Eric Holder's group sues Scott Walker over his refusal for not calling special elections in Wisconsin. The EPA ends grants to study the effect of exposure on the health of adults and children. And lastly, scientists stunned by the high temperatures in the North Pole. Multiple times in February, and they've never seen that. I'm sure.
That's just God's way of saying, let's have an Indian summer.
You know the phrase, keep on trucking? It's a great phrase. That's what it meant.
All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I want to get to two things before we get to the professor on this Janus case. This Janus case is huge. The implications of it could be will be massive in a couple of different ways. I will get to that shortly. I just want to touch on this because this is a case that we followed since 2015 when this rule first went into effect or was contemplated going into effect. The National Labor Relations Board during the Obama years was 3-2 in favor of people who labor to some extent versus people who don't care at all about labor. And when Donald Trump became president shortly thereafter, he had the opportunity to replace one of those board members with another person who doesn't care at all about labor. So the Trump National Labor Relations Board, and they do a lot. I don't think people fully understand exactly how many rules they propagate under the National Labor Relations Act. So in 2015, they had ruled that certain types of franchisees were actually too closely hewn to corporate for those corporations to escape labor rules that were propagated across their company. In other words, McDonald's. Most of the McDonald's you go to are owned by people who are not the McDonald's Corporation. They are franchises. However, the National Labor Relations Board found that the relationship between McDonald's and its franchisees is so close And they have so much control over what workers are hired and what they do and their software that they use and the way that they do payouts that McDonald's cannot escape, let's say, an attempt to unionize by putting a franchise at arm's length. Or they can't escape certain labor practices by putting a franchise at arm's length. So the Obama administration National Labor Relations Board overruled it. And why they did so was because it turns out that a report released in early this month by the agency's inspector general found that William J. Emanuel should have recused himself when the case became before the board in December, shortly after the Republicans gained control. That would have left it split at 2 votes apiece and preserved the status quo. Apparently, this guy had a whole host of conflict of interest.
That's why I put him on there.
It's called conflict of winning.
Good old Billy J.
So a parent company that terminates a franchise agreement to avoid doing business with a franchisee whose workers are trying to unionize may face legal liability for doing so, just as they would have 6 months ago and going forward.
You remember the phrase, to the victor go the spoils? That's the kind of attitude I want on my labor relations board.
So now it's unclear how long this is going to last, right? I mean, it could last several months. This, the status quo, it could last a couple years. It's unclear. I don't know how they'll get around it. Maybe they'll have to wait for another case to come up in which this guy doesn't have a direct conflict of interest. But for the time being, this is good news.
Maybe we'll all get arrested and we won't be able to do anything about it. Who knows?
Let's hope. Meanwhile, when he's not appointing people to the National Labor Relations Board who are Republicans to destroy labor protections, he is also just making sure that he's protecting himself and doesn't give a crap about anyone around him. This is Donald Trump with a massive umbrella. Like, this is like
uncomfortably big umbrella.
I don't know if they make an umbrella bigger than this. Okay? I would have to, like, I think it's actually, it's either, it goes from tarp to this in terms of size of umbrellas. And he's walking up the steps to Air Force One. That is perfectly normal thing to do. Oh, wait, what's that? It's his son running up, who he's left at the bottom of the steps trying to get part of the umbrella. Well, nope, he's not going to give any to Barron. Well, at least he's... Oh, wait, there's Melania. Oh, my God. Let's listen to Lawrence O'Donnell does actually a pretty funny play-by-play on this. Here it is. Good.
But then his 11-year-old son appears behind him, the son he left behind in the rain because protecting his hair is more important than protecting his son. He also left his third and current wife behind him in the rain. She's used to that. She handled it the way she always does, as if she and Donald Trump are just two strangers boarding the same.
Oh, my God. I wish we could find another example of like what normal human beings do. Now, look, this would have been funny if we cared about Donald Trump and he wasn't president, but we wouldn't ever look for it because we didn't care about Donald Trump when he wasn't president. Here is Barack Obama. Just to give you like a little bit of a contrast, we don't have anything with his family. Here he is with two of his advisors coming off of a Marine One in the rain with a big umbrella. And you'll see there it is. He puts the umbrella. It's not as big as Trump's genetics, I guess. But he insists on making sure that both of the advisors are underneath the umbrella. Meanwhile, he's getting soaked. I mean, you can see, like, he's getting completely soaked.
And
he is just making sure that they're under umbrella because he's a normal human being who doesn't despise the other human beings around him. Like
fake news.
Just basic.
Basic human courtesy.
Oh no, but God. Of course, I'm sure if it was with Michelle and Malia, you'd be like, get out, get away.
Yeah, right.
Get away, bitch.
Get away from me.
That's my umbrella.
I need my hair.
Yeah. Just got a new fade.
So there it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, if Trump, if it was Kellyanne Conway and some like Breitbart intern who's now running the national, if it was Ivanka, he would probably be groping her, but she would still be out of the umbrella. Just closer to it, like, so she could be in groping distance.
Yeah. You hold the umbrella.
You hold the umbrella over my head, and then I'll grab you with my free hand.
All right, listen. As you know, there are some Supreme Court cases that I insist that our audience understands better than any other audience of any other show in any medium at any time, anywhere. The Janus case is one of them, just as Friedrich's was, just as King v. Burwell was. That was almost like...
That was a lot.
Yeah. I think we probably graduate lost level. Like 25% of the audience during it's that like, time.
We can't talk about King v. Burwell again, do you see?
All right, but look, here's the deal. There are 21 states, there's 22 states in the country where workers are required to pay a fair share fee. In other words, it was determined, I think it was in either Knox v. SEIU or, I can't remember the other case, that you don't necessarily have to join or pay union dues for their political activity. But as of Abood, maybe it was Abood actually where this split happened in mid-1970s, Abood versus Detroit, the court did find that, look, if you are in a unionized shop and the employer has said, we're going to negotiate only with this union, they get into a contract with the union, we're only going to negotiate with the union, then you as a non-union member must pay what is known as a fair share or an agency fee to the union for negotiating on your behalf. It is well documented that union members and union shops make anywhere from like 10 to 12% more in wages, never mind other benefits. And it also raises the wages of other people in that industry, even if they're not in unions or a unionized shop. But let's leave that aside for a moment. Non-member workers are not required to contribute to the political lobbying activities or the backing of political candidates. In the Janus case, this guy Janus from Illinois argues that because public sector unions are entering bargaining agreements with government, that all of their activity should be seen as political. And that he is being compelled. What's happening to him is compelled speech. That unions, by their very nature, because they do political activity, he is being forced by unions to essentially have political speech he doesn't want. In other words, you've got to pay us workers more, which means you're going to have to raise taxes. And that's political speech, according to him. And therefore, he is being compelled. His speech is being compelled by paying that. And so that is the argument that he's making. We're going to talk to Professor Ann Hodges about the implications of that argument, what the response was in the oral arguments yesterday. And you should know, just as a side note, that there's a study that was recently done. Authors found that the passage of right-to-work measures, which essentially is what Janus would de facto do in these 22 states, decreased Democratic vote share by 2 to 3 percentage points in both presidential and down-ballot elections. 2 to 3 percentage points. That would have swung Wisconsin and Michigan, incidentally. It swings percentage points by 5 to 11% when you talk about statehouse seats. So if you're wondering why the Republicans jones so hard for this, there you have it. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Talk to Ann C. Hodges.
I'm
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program University of Richmond Professor of Law Emeritus Ann Hodges on the Janus case, which was heard in oral arguments yesterday in the Supreme Court. Professor Hodges, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's delightful to be here.
All right. I've just sort of laid out at least the facts of the case that a government employee in Illinois, a guy named Janus, argues to the court, obviously through counsel and other folks, that by being compelled to pay agency fees to a union, that his speech, that political speech is being compelled by him. Why is he making the argument that his speech is being compelled as opposed to restricted, right? I mean, these are two elements, I guess, of free speech.
Yes, and I think this argument comes from the notion that essentially money is speech. And so we've seen this in the area of political contributions, the court saying that in fact a political contribution is a form of speech. And so Janus's argument is that he is being required to pay the union to represent him in collective bargaining. And by the way, the union is required by law to represent him. That is, the union is mandated to provide these services to all of the employees in the bargaining group. Many of them will be members of the union and will pay membership dues. But under an earlier Supreme Court case, the court held that employees who choose not to be members of the union, they can be required to pay for the union's representation of them, that is, for collective bargaining, for handling their grievances in the workplace, but not for the union's political activity. So if the union is...
That was the Abood case, right? Abood
right.
v. Detroit from the mid-70s. And what is the law that compels a union to cover, is that a federal law, is that a state law, to negotiate on behalf of all the employees in a shop?
Well, in this particular case, it's the law of the state of Illinois, because Janus is a public employee in Illinois. That same duty applies, for example, to unions in the private sector under the Federal National Labor Relations Act. So, and it is... The duty is there because in the United States, we have a system of exclusive representation, unlike in most other developed countries where unions represent only their members and where you might have multiple unions representing employees who do the same job for the same employer. In the United States, we have a system of exclusive representation, which means that when a majority of the employees in the bargaining group choose a union, that union represents everyone, and no other union can come in and represent those employees. That
I imagine
benefits
that's,
employers.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, I would imagine that benefits the specific unions to some extent, but at the end, it's really a benefit to employers.
Absolutely. You're precisely correct, because employers then only have to deal with one union, and they can have one contract governing all of the employees in the bargaining group. One set of, you know, the wages, the benefits, all of that can be uniform, and they don't have multiple unions coming at them trying to deal with the terms and conditions of employment for employees who do the same job.
Okay, so was that in the formation of the National Labor Relations Act? Was that the concern? Was that the idea that we're going to do this for simplicity? I imagine there would be lobbying from like some pre-existing union players there who were like, okay, we're going to be the sole union, so we should support this. But I would imagine you had this industry essentially saying, yeah, this makes it much easier for us too.
Yes, I think it is true that it is much easier for the employers. If we have to deal with the union, which, you know, certainly today most employers don't want to do, although we had a period of time in this country where we had a lot of very stable union management relationships, and to some extent, some of those still exist, right, certainly, and some in the public sector as well.
Mostly in the public sector, in terms of union density at this time anyways, or I should say mostly, are union sector, public sector unions.
Yes, so, absolutely. The union density in the public sector is around 34-35%. In the private sector, it's down between 6-7%.
Okay, so we have this situation where unions are compelled to represent everyone in a shop, largely for the benefit of the employer. Makes it much easier, particularly when you're, you know, you're a government entity. But I would imagine that's also the case for private employers as well. So we have this situation, and Abood says that we can split the difference between what the unions use for political activity and what they use for the sort of the nuts and bolts of actually having to negotiate a contract. It costs money. Corporations have human resources departments. Unions have something similar that meets them and negotiates. And so the theory is what? That Janice has a problem with this.
Well, Janice's argument is essentially collective bargaining is political speech. And so you can't draw a line between the union's political activity and their engagement in representation. So he's arguing that the Abood case from 40 years ago should be reversed, overruled, and that he should not be required to pay for collective bargaining either, because that is no different, he argues, than the union's political activity. It's still political speech. It's deserving of the highest protection. Therefore, his argument is there must be some compelling government interest to justify this, and the interest in this system of stable labor relations, of labor peace, and of avoiding the problem of what we call free riders, that is, individuals who accept the benefits of union representation but don't pay for it, that none of those justify requiring him to pay for collective bargaining, because collective bargaining is political speech.
Well, how does one make that argument? How does one make the argument that collective bargaining, is that only for public sector unions? Is that for all unions? Is it not the case that, like, when Walmart sets a policy for all its employees, that they are also engaging in collective bargaining? I mean, what is the I can understand him arguing, like, okay, this does not rise to a state interest enough where you could supersede the First Amendment. But I don't understand what the argument is that somehow collective bargaining, the act of bargaining, is speech, or is, like, political speech.
Well, the argument, I think, here is that specifically focused on the public sector. I think we will see these same people who are funding Janice's case pushing a similar argument in the private sector, but perhaps not identical. So the argument here really is we're talking about the government. We're talking about how the government spends money. And so when we have collective bargaining, we're talking about substantial amounts of government spending, and how the government spends money is political, in essence. And so, and they also differentiate. They seem to be, and this is Janice's argument I'm making here, that if one employee goes to the government and says, I want a raise, negotiate with me about that, that's not political speech because it doesn't have a sufficient impact on the government expenditures. But if it's done collectively through the union, that it is political speech. That's their argument.
Now, and so if I was sitting on the Supreme Court, I might say, that's an interesting theory, Mr. Janus. Can you tell us at what point, if an individual comes and asks for a significant raise, that it reaches the constitutional muster of speech? I mean, that seems to be the dilemma there, right? Like, how do you, what if the union comes and doesn't ask for a raise? Is that no longer political speech?
Well, I think that you've put your finger on a problem with their argument. And in fact, some of the justices asked those kinds of questions. Where do you draw that line? They seem to be drawing the line at, you know, when it is done collectively through a union. They did not sort of parse through, I think, very well, the plaintiff's lawyers, Janus's lawyers, because the justices made that point as well. So they pointed out that things like, you know, when someone takes their paid time off and who takes paid time off when, is something that might be covered in a collective bargaining agreement. Is that political speech? That's a hard argument to make, but what the Janus lawyers were saying is that any kind of collective bargaining is going to involve government expenditures, and therefore it is political speech.
Now, if it's the case that expending that significant, whatever that means, a government expenditure that is solicited by an entity, right? Because an entity is made up of individuals, I guess, and if they're doing it together, that would make it collective. Then how is, like, when, I don't know, Boeing goes to get a contract, how is that not sort of political speech? And how is, let's say, an employee of Boeing not compelled to... How is it they're not being compelled? Their free speech is not being in some way implicated because, I don't know, they get money from Boeing or they have some type of relationship with Boeing. I'm not sure. What about in that scenario? Or am I not quite getting the principle that Janus is articulating?
Well, no, I think you are getting it, and I think that's a substantial argument. I mean, you might say the Boeing stockholder, right?
Right.
Might be someone who is, you know, giving money to Boeing. Can they then object to Boeing's speech and if they are lobbying the government? And I think that really is the end result of this argument. And I think there is a significant argument that they're really opening up. I've called it a Pandora's box because there are all sorts of situations where people pay money, and often it is compelled payments to organizations that then engage in something that might be considered political speech.
Let's go through those. For instance, okay, the Bar Association, right? You cannot be a practicing attorney unless you are a member of your state's Bar Association. That Bar Association engages, you know, in relations with the government. They lobby in certain instances. They may be accredited or licensed. I mean, I would imagine any licensing entity, whether it's like for barbers or whatnot, right? They all engage in this stuff. That seems to me to be a similar situation.
Yes, I think it is. And I think now what Janus's lawyers would say is, and actually the Supreme Court has addressed the question of lawyers and drew the same line based on the Abood case that the court drew in Abood. So I think if the court reverses Abood or overrules Abood in this case, then that does call into question these licensing, these occupational licensing requirements, because they've been upheld on the basis of Abood. But if Abood goes down, then I think it calls all those into question. And we may see a lot more of these cases. Now, what Janice's lawyers would say is, well, there are government interests that justify those intrusions. But in each of these cases, there's going to be a question. If we're talking about First Amendment speech here, there may be lawsuits filed, and there may be there's going to have to be some inquiry into the justification. So what is the justification for compelling, you know, lawyers to subsidize this speech, or as you say, barbers, or any other sort of occupational licensing situation? People are mandated to pay fees to homeowners associations if they live in particular developments. People are required to buy auto insurance. So they're paying money to an auto insurance
And we should say company. That these entities, these homeowners groups, very often will try and get lower taxes, let's say. And if, you know, maybe I don't want lower taxes, but they're taking my money and they're using that in some way to support the idea of lower taxes. Or I pay my auto insurance. These insurance companies are certainly, you know, lobbying the government in some fashion, right? And getting their rates set. So, I mean, this opens up that entire Pandora's box. I mean, I bet we could sit here for hours and come up with examples of this. The idea that, I mean, my rent, right? I mean, like, presumably I'm paying rent to a landlord. You know, I'm compelled to pay rent to live here or to work here. I'm paying it to a landlord. The landlord, the management company, they probably belong to a trade association that lobbies the government. They, you know, send in $96 a year or whatever it is. I mean, it seems to me this is all this could just keep going and going. Yes.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think very interestingly, there was a brief filed in this case by several very conservative scholars of the First Amendment. And they make precisely this argument that we shouldn't be considering this kind of thing speech at all, because it does open up all of these areas for challenge. And it was perhaps kind of surprising to see these very conservative scholars making this sort of an argument on behalf of the unions, actually, in this case, and defending the rule that defending Abood and siding with the unions and the state government, both of whom argued that Janice's you know, First Amendment rights were not being infringed here.
All right. Well, let's. I want to just put a slight pin in that aspect of it, because that's going to have implications, not necessarily with this court, but maybe with other federal courts, or, you know, going forward in terms of the Supreme Court. But I just want to go back to one other element of this as we talk about this distinction between restricted speech and compelled speech, right? Because I know that you've looked at the transcripts from the oral arguments yesterday. People were waiting sort of, there wasn't a lot of suspense about this. People sort of knew that where the different players were after Friedrichs, the case that ended up being stalemated because Antonin Scalia was quite timely in his exit from his from our his presence on our earth, and I'm not going to put you in a uncomfortable situation of sharing my continued emotion about that, but be that as it may. So this Anthony Kennedy wrote And I'm not sure which case it was. I don't know if it was the Abood case or one of the subsequent cases, Knox or others, that government employers, like private employers, need a significant degree of control over their employees' words and actions. Without it, there'd be little chance for the efficient provision of public services. So in other words, if I'm the city of Chicago and I have deemed that I am going to... this is going to be a this is going to be a union shop. The union statutorily represents everyone in the office, essentially, and therefore I'm exercising a certain amount of control. I can restrict their speech to a certain extent because they're my employees. But this guy's argument is different, that he's actually being compelled to say something to be in favor, let's say, of more government spending. What's the difference between, you know, historically in the law, between compelled speech and restricted speech, and as someone like, you know, where does Sam Alito, a strict constructionalist, or Neil Gorsuch, a strict constructionalist, see this distinction between compelled speech and restricted speech? Because it occurs to me that restricted speech would be almost worse than compelled speech, because it's compelled speech is more of like an inference, right?
Well, and I think particularly in this case, because Janice is not actually being compelled to speak. Janice is being required to fund someone else, the union, which is then speaking. Janice has every right to go to the government and lobby in opposition and to speak out in opposition to everything that the union is saying. He can, yes, he has to pay this fee, which is then used by the union. And so in effect, he is subsidizing in a way the union speech, if in fact collective bargaining is political speech. But he has a complete right to do any number of things. He can speak himself and say what he believes in opposition to that.
He could stand
anywhere,
outside
everywhere.
Of that. He could stand outside of that bargaining room with the sign that says, "Don't pay us more money."
Right. Absolutely. You know, he can email his employer. He can go to his boss. He can say over, you know, anywhere he wants to. He can go to the Illinois legislature and say, "Don't appropriate more money to my agency so it can pay additional money to the employees under the collective bargaining contract." He has a right to try to get rid of his union. He can, there is a whole process under the law where you can, what's called, decertify the union. So if he can convince enough of his fellow employees that the union is not doing a good job, they can vote the union out. They can vote a different union in. They can have no union. There's a whole process for that. So he has a lot of rights. And I think this kind of, if we want to call it compelled speech, is something somewhat different than if Janice was, you know, somebody put a gun to his head and he had to stand up and, you know, proclaim something that he did not believe.
Or even if they said, we're going to fire you from this shop. I mean, like, this isn't even like it doesn't even seem to be like any economic coercion. It seems to be to the extent that he's being coerced to subsidize this speech. And I think that's as far as it goes. He is being coerced to do so by statute. And isn't it statute that coerces me to pay taxes? And certainly the government expends money in ways that I don't like. And so how is that not compelled speech?
Absolutely. And you, the government, the union is a democratic institution. So the union can be voted in and voted out, the same as our representatives can be voted in and voted out. And we do that on a majority basis. So if a majority of us vote in someone, I may not like them, but they're my representative and they represent me until I convince majority of my fellow citizens to vote them out. And they may vote to do things that I don't like and to spend my tax money in ways that I don't like. But that's our system. And our, you know, collective bargaining system in the United States is based very much on a similar principle. The majority rule, the ability to convince the majority to get rid of the union, the ability to speak out separate and apart from the union, all of that is built in. So it's very much a system like our political system.
I'm super, like, the first thing that really comes to mind is this car insurance, because every state in the country, you are compelled to buy car insurance. And just like I'm not compelled to work in, you know, for the sanitation department of the city of Chicago, I'm not compelled to drive my car. But if I want to work for the sanitation department of the city of Chicago, I got to pay these agency fees. If I want to drive my car, I got to pay for this car insurance. But these car insurance companies, there is no doubt in my mind that they have lobbied the U.S. government, or that they've actually, they belong to some groups in some fashion or another that that expresses a political idea that I don't like. And I just don't understand how I can be compelled, after Janice is going to be found, and I think there's very little suspense about this, how I can be compelled to pay car insurance at that point.
I think we're going to see those lawsuits. And actually, interestingly, there's several unions in Illinois and Wisconsin that have already filed some lawsuits in anticipation of Janus. One of them has filed against a community in Illinois, I think it's Lincolnshire, where the individual is saying, my tax money is being used by my community to lobby for things that I object to. They're a part of the Illinois Municipal League, and the Illinois Municipal League has lobbied for right-to-work laws and in opposition to public sector bargaining. I'm a union member. I believe in public sector bargaining. I oppose right-to-work laws. My tax money is being used, that I'm compelled to pay to my city, is being paid to the Municipal League, another organization, to do things that I object to. So there already has been, you know, to my knowledge, at least one lawsuit that was filed last week in anticipation of this ruling in Janus.
And my understanding is
we'll see more of those.
There's a suit in a federal lawsuit against Scott Walker in Wisconsin, because the law he signed in 2011 restricts public employee collective bargaining rights. And the theory is that if collective bargaining is speech in the Janus case, and therefore he's being compelled, his speech is being compelled. In this instance, the restriction on collective bargaining would be a restriction of free speech. I mean, how does restrictions on wildcat strikes under Taft-Hartley, how does that stand? I mean, if collective bargaining, if the act of collective bargaining can compel free speech, then clearly the prevention of it can, or the subjugation of it is a restriction of free speech. Then how can you have no strikes? How can you have no wildcat strikes? How is that possible? How is that not all a restriction of First Amendment rights? Or is that just like there was found that the government has a compelling interest?
Well, I think, yes, you have to look at whether or not there's a compelling interest. And there might be a compelling interest in those cases. But it does raise, I think, the issue again, because we have not said in the past that collective bargaining is political speech, and political speech is speech of the highest order. We have treated collective bargaining as, you know, a form of, some people have called it economic speech, but at the very least, you know, a form of speech that has, you know, less protection than political speech, which has the highest form of protection. So if it is the speech that has the highest form of protection, then the government interest has to be much stronger in limiting it. And, it might be that in a case, certain kinds of cases of strikes, the government interest might be found to be sufficiently compelling.
First responders, let's say, as an example, right?
Exactly. Exactly. But I think in other sorts of situations, for example, teachers are prohibited from striking in most states, not all states. All public employees are prohibited from striking in many states, in most states. So why is it, the clerks in the water department, they're prohibited from striking. Why is there some compelling interest in prohibiting those individuals from striking? They're not like first responders.
So just to be clear on this dynamic so that people understand, pre-Janus, let's assume we're living in a post-Janus world, because I think we're about 6 months off from that. But in pre-Janus world, the government could keep, could say that the guy or the gal working in the public works department as a clerk can't strike because the government has a compelling interest. It's not hugely compelling, but it's compelling enough to meet the standard of suppressing economic speech, for the lack of a better term. However, post-Janus, that economic speech will be elevated to political speech, which requires a higher compulsion need by the state, the government, to subjugate that speech. And this is going to open up that question now anew, because the speech itself has been elevated in its requirement of the compelling interest by government.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Well, this should be interesting. And like you say, guys like Eugene Volk, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, have put in amicus briefs arguing with, on the side that people like you would be arguing, I would imagine, that this is going to open up a lot of problems, perhaps. And the point is that this notion of compelled speech that are not generally viewed as burdening any First Amendment interest, there could be a lot of cases. And we still, despite the fact that Donald Trump has been quite vigorous in appointing federal judges, we still have like a lot of federal judges out there who are going to basically take that element of Janus and perhaps apply it to other scenarios. Is there a way that a guy like Alito, it seems to me, or Gorsuch, could fashion the Janus ruling in such a way that they do one of those like, hey, it's just for this scenario type of thing?
Well, I think that may be what they might try to do. And I think there is an element of this that is how it fits in their mindset. That is, there's an element of sort of unions are bad and collective bargaining rights aren't important. And we don't really understand or support the whole system. So therefore it's not important. There's not a strong interest here on the part of the government. So I think it's more in balancing the interest that they think they can make this distinction. And of course, whenever you have a balancing test, those are good tests in a sense because you can take into account a lot of interests, but as people often say, sort of the weight of various interests is in some senses in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
And the beholder, is the judge. So I think that's where they think that line can be drawn. But, not everyone sees it in the same way. I mean, I think there are other ways that this decision might be compromised, but I'm not sure. Certainly I don't see Alito going for a narrower compromise. Gorsuch, Justice Gorsuch, of course, was completely silent in the argument. So we have no sense from the argument as to how he might go. We probably have a sense, I think there's the reason people are predicting that Janus is going to win is his general judicial philosophy and conservative background.
Let me, and I think that was a very polite way of you saying that with some of these justices, they have a preordained outcome that is a function of their political ideology. Maybe not. I don't want to put words into your mouth. Let me ask you just one final question, just because this is, you know, and hopefully this is a question that will be dispelled, that is more or less not have to be dispelled. Is there any doubt in your mind that if Merrick Garland was sitting on this court right now, that this Janus case would have even been taken?
Yeah, I'm not sure it would have been taken. And certainly I think there would be a much greater chance that it would come out if the justices did take the case. There would be a much greater chance that it would come out 5-4 in favor of the state of Illinois and the union.
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. Professor Ann Hodges, University of Richmond, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. I enjoy talking to law professors. Sorry. I really do.
Don't ever apologize for that.
That was like one of those. That's like a classic. Like, I'm sorry. I'm not really sorry. That was. That's. Yeah. There's not a word for that. Like, I regret to inform you that I really enjoy talking to law professors, and this is going to be difficult for some of you, folks. This show, I shouldn't have prefaced this a call to become a member with that. But this show relies on your membership. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Think of it as like an abbreviated Barron's course in law school. Like, you'll just see the big cases. Just the big ones. Maybe we'll do like a special on Griswold or something like that. Like, every now and then we'll just do a case from like 60 years ago.
That's actually a great idea.
That's actually not a bad
idea. It's analogous to illicit histories on my show.
Yes, that would actually be a good, like a bonus. Maybe like a good vacation show, too. We're going to talk about two of this person's favorite cases. I wonder how badly that show would perform.
And then, of course, there was the, well, that was a big case.
How great would that be? It was like somebody said that they were offering.
Do you think that? You think it is?
No,
possible?
I actually think that that might overperform.
Do you think it would? Do you
not
think
relative
possible?
To like other shows?
Do you think
it
it's possible that if Donald Trump was asked, like, can you name one important legal case in the history of the United States? I mean, he would probably.
What
say,
was that one that Dad hated about
Trump
our buildings?
Trump v. DOJ. Yeah.
Trump v. DOJ, no. And it was a very.
Everyone knows that. And it almost wouldn't even have to be said.
Somebody was offering a couple $100 or something, I think, to anybody in the White House press corps that would, oh man, what's the name of the Black Panther country? Wakanda. Like what Trump thought of relations with Wakanda.
Folks, join themajorityreport.com. You will support this show on a daily basis. And as a way of saying thank you, we say, hey, here's some more content. Oh, maybe you don't like talking to a law professor. Skip the free half today. Go right to the fun half. That's the way that works. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop. That's literally .coop. I don't know. Some people are like, "What are you? What does that mean, .coop? Well, no, but I'm saying, like, some people, like, I know what .com is, and I know what .net or .mobi.
Music.
But, yeah, if you
cooperative
do
a show, excuse me.
What?
I'm out of it. Cooperative business.
Business. Yeah. Yes, coffee.
Excuse me.
coffee business, not coffee not music.
Not coffee music.
JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, tonight is Tuesday, if you are not aware of it. On Tuesdays, more often than not, there's been, I think, one occasion where it was not a Tuesday, TMBS happens. That is the Michael Brooks Show. Other people have other acronyms. I mean, that acronyms means for other people. I'm not going to mention it because sensitivities. You don't want to rub people the wrong way. But you can find it in like 4chan when they start talking about TMBS. You can find out what the other people call it.
You read our, who's on read our contract.
Who is on tonight?
Corey Pine and Trevor, Ricky Rawls. And we were talking about Silicon Valley. Corey's new book's coming out, Live, Work, 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 Die. And then Trevor and I are going to talk about Black Panther.
Oh, we're going to maybe have that guy, Ricky Rawls, on to do a Friday spot too, right?
And then also there's this big thing that's happening in the UK where the right-wing tabloids are targeting Jeremy Corbyn with this accusation that he was an Easter, a spy for the Czech Republic in the 80s. Mm. And it's been pretty thoroughly debunked.
Who wasn't a spy for the Czech Republic in the 80s?
Well, that's exactly. You're stepping on how I'm going to deal with the story tonight.
Oh, sorry about that. Well, you shouldn't have said anything. Also, from Britain, basically, the functional equivalent of the Department of Homeland Security director stepping down. It's 31 years. Mark Rowley. He was the assistant commissioner at the Metropolitan Police. They had four far right wing plots, terror plots that were thwarted last year. I guess in I don't know if it was just in the UK or in London in particular. Something to note. There's also a big strike going over there with lecturers.
Oh, right. Yes.
There you go. I just reminded you. There you have it.
That is another good thing.
That's the way we program around here, folks. It's the way it happens.
It's a grind,
man. And also, it's a total grind. And also, speaking of grind, justcoffee.coop, 10% off. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Jamie, what's new on your Patreon?
Not much, I'm afraid. I've been tied up working on this book proposal. However, yes, I know. Everyone's going to quit. It's going to be a miserable
failure.
I've
got things to do, goddammit.
But
why is she getting that voice?
That was actually earlier when she was coughing a lot. I personified her lungs as sounding like you, and that was just carrying over.
I'll never smoke again.
Yeah,
I've got two.
See, it was a good motivation.
Sam's in my chest. It was just a good fetching at me every time I do it now.
Stop taking Sean's
cigarettes. Wait, why am I the personification of smoke-addled lungs?
No. Like Jewish kvetching and nonsense.
Yeah,
that's what you're the personification.
I'm a non-smoker. I'm putting smoke in my nice, pure Jewish lungs, and that is bad.
Saying we can't take it.
And
so
now
I'm just
hear your
the
voice
personification
in my head
of
when
badness.
I do it.
Is that what I'm hearing?
No, you're not listening.
Aw.
You're the good.
Give yourself
goodness.
Some. Give yourself you're, some.
I'm the pure.
You're
lungs.
The goodness, the good Jewish lungs that I'm polluting with bad.
You,
goyish
her,
not,
her lungs are like nice Jewish boys who are very sensitive.
All right, well, that
I'm
going to
read about
that
the Janus case,
sense.
And that ended up getting
please,
smoked
no sense.
Instead.
Please,
ow.
No
but
smells.
I am working on a new blog post about gun control, so that should be up soon.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. You can
socialist
check that out at
case for lock and load,
patreon.com slash Jamie Peck. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will be back in the fun half.
Do you see?